accession number 11063, rule 7.
Mr. Byrne, rule 7.
Anyway, these were, they called them paquettas. God, did they stink. Well, the other lads then were across from me. Some had their arms wrapped up and some had their... most had their feet wrapped up. There were only us could walk. Only me and Robbie could walk about. The second mate, he went back to sea, I don't know, but he couldn't walk at that time. And so one amusing parts, you know the bottle when you want to go to the toilet? Well, they only had a couple of them, and they reserved them for such as Bill Short, and I think Bell had one, and there were another fella, a Portuguese had one. I think he lost two hands and 2 feet. He went off the ballot. I think Bill Short will tell you more. I think he lost 2 hands and 2 feet. I think they called him Carlos. Anyway, I got the job of when they wanted to wee, putting the bottle in between the legs. Well, it was a bit farcical. You had to pull the bedclothes back and put this jam jar between the legs and get them in a position to pee. And then they'd say, give us a cig, Titch. And so you put a cig between into the mouth and then you lit it. And they played on about the quality of the tobacco, and they couldn't tell you, like the lifeboat, they couldn't tell you when they wanted to pull it out. And so I used to end up sat between a bed, pulling 2 cigs out, both at once, when they nodded. Now one day I was giving a fella a wee, and I put his, in the bottle, and he said the bottle was cold. And then he said, I'll have a cig. So I said, are you going to go wash your hands before you give me a cig? I said, Nate, it's your thing, I've just been hold of, but it calmed down then. But one thing, I forgot that. The first day, the second day we're in hospital, the ballot then got there. So the people I was talking about was on the ballot when she got bombed. And then they got on the Sylvia, and then they got on our ship. I said they were on 3 ships, and if they'd have stopped on the first ship, they'd have got safely to Murmansk. Well, I think there were 16 had bombed, and I think there were 5 lived. The skipper came in to see him, and they had a mate aboard there, a chief mate, I think he was, and they were Estonian, he spoke Russian, but he never, the ballot, the people off the ballot that came in with him, never moved above 2 paces from him. He just didn't trust the Russians. They never moved. Wherever he moved, they moved, or he moved, they moved. Anyway, they came in and somebody said, how are you for food? And so, well, you know, this, that and other. And typical at a medic, and said, oh, it's terrible. Anyway, day after then, the cook came in and he brought this great big raisin pie. I've never had raisin pie since. I'd never had it before. It was about 2 inch thick. And you got to bear in mind, this was in... Raisins were strictly rationed in England. Anyway, he cut it into pieces and gave them some. And there were one big piece left. And they were going to give it to Smith, the fireman. And all of a sudden, one of the others said, no, give it to the boy there. He got us here. Without him, I wouldn't have got here. So with that, he turned away from Smith. And they were giving it to me. And I looked at it, I thought, well, it's lovely. And I don't know, I said, cut it in two and give my friend half. That was a big decision. It took a lot of giving, but I gave Robbie half of my piece of pie. But it was real. It was. But we just went on then with bombing, and every day we were bombed. Most days, it was, you know, lunchtime. I always used to sit and imagine at lunchtime that the pilots were having a good dinner and having the schnapps and say, come on, we'll go bomb them again. Anyway, one day they came in and they put a thing round Robinson's arm, and then all of a sudden they injected him and he went, ooh, and he went out. And then she turned to me with equipment and his eyes went round in rings and he went out. Well, I said, no. Well, I jumped over the chief steward who was saying, mind my legs, mind my legs, mind my legs. And all the chief steward could say, well, I wish I had my pantry in there. We'd have some good food. And why don't they send some good food out to UK for us? If they knew I were here, they'd send a Sunderland out with it. And I'd say, well, you can't have it. You know your pantry's at bottom at Barents Sea. But anyway, this day, she came in and she jogged him. And I jumped over the steward. And she said, she started chasing me. She was big. She could hold me down with 2 thumbs. No argument about that. Anyway, all of a sudden, there were extra heavy air raid and building shook. vroom, you know, and they get that thud when it goes right in the ground near you. Vroom. Oh, I thought, hell. And all of a sudden she said, Nick, Nick, back to bed. Well, she didn't say back to bed, but she said, Nick, like, you know. And so I got back in bed and she said, no. Anyway, I went air raid and finished. The head interpreter come and she said, they want you to have an injection. I said, yes, but I'm not having that. I said, look at him. Well, this was about an hour later, and Robbie was still out. I said, no, no way. No, I'm not having that. I'm running again. Anyway, she said, when I talk to you, you will have the injection, and you will tell me of your own free will that you will have it. Anyway, the doctor came, and the doctor started running her hands through my head. And so I said to the interpreter, tell her I ain't lousy. I've got no nits. What? I said, not, no louse. I'm clean. So she said something to her, and she patted my face, and that was it. And anyway, she said, the doctor assures me that you won't go out like him. You won't pass out like him. I said, it makes no difference. I'm not having it. She said, it is only vodka. I said, I don't believe you. She said, it is only vodka, and when I leave you, you will tell me of your own free will that you will have it. Well, she settled down and we talked. She's a lovely person. And we talked, and we had quite a long talk. And she said, now about this vodka. I said, how do I know it's vodka? She said, that's what bothers you. I said, yes. She said, if you know it's vodka, you will have it. I said, yes. She said, I told you you would have it of your own free will if I talked to you long enough. I said, if it's vodka, and I see it loaded. She said, correct, you will see it loaded, and I told you you would have it of your own free will. Anyway, they brought this stranger, this great big stranger. I don't know how big strangers go to, but it seemed a big one to me. And there were none of this, a fresh needle for every fella, you know, then it was just the same needle. Anyway, they brought this bottle of vodka. Well, she did her nut. She did her nut, because it was half empty. And I just looked, I would have prepared to have that, wouldn't it, but it looked vodka to me. She said, I told them I want a new one. You are having it of your own free will, and you would break the seal. So they brought the other bottle, and she inspected the seal and showed me. She said, now the needle goes through the seal. Anyway, the needle went through the seal, and they put this vodka into me. But no doctor I've ever spoke to know what they give us it for. But then again, they know the medicine. But I didn't pass out. I think I was too scared. Anyway, I was there about 12 days. And over the other side, though, they see a Portuguese. And they couldn't get across to him. They couldn't speak his language. And I remember him getting the doctor, the interpreter, a Welshman. The doctor told the interpreter told the Welshman, who translated it from English, because the Ronium could make this Chilean understand the language. The Russian interpreter couldn't understand the Chilean, and the Chilean interpreted it in some other language for the poor patient, because they were Portuguese. So it went from the patient to the Chilean, to the Welshman, to the interpreter, to the doctor. But I think, as I said, I think he lost both arms and both legs. I think they called him Carlos. Anyway, I used to go look round, and it was at this time, after about the third or fourth day, that the penny really dropped to me. It hadn't then, that no one else was coming. I'd always had a deep down feeling that possibly somebody else had come. I don't know what I'd expected, but I'd always expected that some divine providence had sent a boat from somewhere and got the skipper and the mate. But it was at this time then that it dawned on me that there were only us there and others weren't coming. Anyway, we were there and he got bombed, and I don't think there's aught else I can say but about that. But one thing I forgot to say, when we set off from UK, they started giving us these pills to take, and they were big. As big as your fingernail, they were big. And they were supposed to be to thicken your blood up quickly for cold weather. And it said on packet you got them in that they contained all sorts of stuff, and olive oil, and cod liver oil, and shark's liver oil. And it take two a day. Well, the gunner, Kelly, said to me, take them. He said, in 8 days' time, it'll be colder than you'll ever know. I should have had this in earlier on, I'm sorry about this. He said, it'll be colder than you'll ever know. He said, if others don't take them, get theirs, and me and you take double doses. So it ended up, instead of taking two of them a day, me and him were taking four, because others won't take theirs. I often thought, looking back since, that that helped a lot. But Kelly didn't live through it. The last time I saw Kelly, he'd done what he told me not to do. He'd slept without his coat and his boots on. And when we were at lifeboat stations, he came running on deck. I thought, well, after all you told me, and I did what you'd told me, He must have been in a really tired and really his band end, must Kelly, to get. But then again, his cabin was so far above waterline. But what he were doing, getting undressed to go to bed, I don't know. When he drilled me so much, and I'd done it, but the poor soul went with her. I think, as far as I know, he were getting married. When he got home, he'd said to me, I think he came from Doncaster, and he wouldn't get married when he got home. But he didn't, Douglas, he didn't get home. But I didn't know where he came from. Anyway, we were in hospital there, and as I said, the naval officer used to come in and see us. And then he said, he'd talked to me on a few occasions, and he'd said, you are Royal Navy? I said, yes. He said, how are you going to go home? Well, I thought, that's your worry, mate, not mine. He said, I think you deserve a bit. Is it your first trip to sea? I said, yep. Yeah. I've never been away before. The only time I've seen a ship were in Liverpool when I went to New Brighton, and Middlesbrough when I went up to Redcar from Docks. He said, good heavens. He said, you'll deserve better than going out of here on a merchant ship as a replacement gunner. But they'll be wanting replacement gunners for the convoy home. There's some gunners missing. Anyway, after a few days, he said, 8 or 9 days, he said, HMS Liverpool's coming. Don't tell anyone. She's replacing the cruiser. At that time, I didn't know the Trinidad were damaged. She's coming up to take the convoy home. Anyway, he said, I'll see if I can get your passage. Anyway, he came in and he said, HMS Liverpool arrives tomorrow. The commander, I always liked his style. It was typical upper-class British, you know. The commander is a friend of father's. I will ask him to do you a favour and take you home on his ship. Real, no more than that. You deserve, that's what you deserve. And after all, you are Royal Navy. He said, can you walk aboard? I said, yes. He said, I hope you know it is going home as a fighting ship. I said, yes. I said, but if I go out on one of these merchant ships, what will it be? He said, a fighting ship, if it can. You'll be better on that. I said, yes. So with that, day after he came in and he said, I'm going up to see the commander of HMS Liverpool. Wish me well and I'll see if I can get your passage home. But by the way, what are you going to wear? I said, well, I said, when I came in here, we dropped his clothes on the floor. I said, and since then, they've brought us, been through his pockets and brought his stuff back. I lost my rosary beads. I got my money belt back. It had £9 in. I've still a pound note down back lounge. It's framed, is that? I always kept that pound note. I spent the others. I always kept that pound note. And a few years since, my son said, it's too bad to carry around with you. I carried it wherever I went. And a year ago, I pensioned it off. It's framed it back now. Well, not lads will get it when I've gone. And anyway, he said, well, we'll have to get you some clothes. He said, there's some clothes come for the Polish relief, but they're lousy, you can't wear them. So anyway, he came back in the afternoon. I've seen the commander, and he gave him his name, and I've asked him, and he said, yes, he will take you home as a favour to me. So you're going home. Who can walk? I said, well, I can, and they can. I said, but I don't know about others. Anyway, they took six of us home. One of them, he was a Manchester lad, he was older than me, and his fingers were rotting on his right hand, and you could actually see his flesh were coming off, and you could actually see bones, it were green. But they shipped him home because he could walk, so Russians didn't operate on him. It turned out afterwards that the Russians had no anaesthetic, and their method of amputation was just a guillotine or a pair of pliers. Well, I've found out since that if they chop your leg, if they do it here, they're kind of round the bone, attack the limb. But the Russians doing it, it's a straight cut. And they did it. They were actually doing it, pardon me, without any anaesthetic. I didn't know that then because the others had no amputations when I left, and it was afterwards that I found out that they'd all had amputations. Anyway, when I were leaving, I said, we're going home, and Charlie Alberg, the American, said, I'll give you my address, write to me. So I got his address, I got the Belgium third mate's address in America, and I got William Morris's address. Now, in the lifeboat, William Morris were full of how well you've done, and when we got ashore, he were full of how well he'd done. And Smith, whose head I was going to kick in, when we were in hospital in Murmansk, the Americans came in, he were full of how full of he'd done in the boat, and had done nothing. But one day when we were in hospital in Murmansk, there was a big rush round to tidy up, and all we could get is through the interpreter, very important people coming in. Anyway, evidently, from what I don't understand it much, but the war committee ran the theatre up there, and these three guys come in, in baggy silks, and they shook hands, and each one of them shook hands with us and thanked us through the interpreters, and it would turn out to be that they were the top commissars of the area, and they'd come specially to thank us for a brave, they called it, thank you for a brave effort, pity, forget now, a brave try and a good effort, but you know, hard luck. Anyway, they did come and thank us. Anyway, the next day they brought these Russian uniforms up, and we put full Russian uniform on with some more of them underpants that have a button at top, next button, next fastening somewhere up back, and we went down to the we said goodbye to everybody and went down the stairs into an ambulance and then down onto a slope, minesweeper or something, I forget the name of her, and up to HMS Liverpool at Pollyanna. Well, when we're on this slope, let's remember this, they said, what are you like? We're in Russian uniform. And survivors. Oh, we're taking you down to HMS Liverpool. We said, yes. Have you eaten today? We said, well, we've been on Russian grub. Well, they'd seen Russian grub that the Russians were getting. Well, we'd been slightly better because we'd been on, you know, what we were getting. We were slightly better than the Russians. It was rough, but they gave us what they had. Didn't nobody ever call them a mate. They gave us what they had. And the traitors reaped quite well. Anyway, he said, one of them went away, and all of a sudden this guy come back, and he evidently what, cook? And he said, the best I can give you quick like this is McConaughey's steak and kidney pudding. To which we said, yes. Anyway, I think they must have warmed it up quick with a steam jet. I'm not sure, because it was no time at all. It was back, and it were in these tins, and it were piping hot. And so I slipped on this form, and I were right up against the bulkhead, and they doled it out, and oh, we got big aches. No potatoes, no nothing there, nothing like that. And thank you. I had a right good. So all of a sudden they said, anybody want any more? So I've always been a good eater. I said, yes, please. So I had two helpings. And then went all to the cinema, how full they were and this sort of stuff. I just looked round and there were one helping and they were just going to scrape it in the gas bucket. I said, is that gas? He said, yes. I said, give me it, I'll eat it. So I had three plates of that, and that was best first good meal I'd had in a, oh, I don't know how long, because when we were going up to Russia, we were eating, they gave you good food, did the cook, but at two on and two off and four on and four off, you didn't know where you were and you didn't eat right well. Anyway, we went up to HMS Liverpool, went aboard HMS Liverpool, they gave us some blankets and a camp bed and told us where we were sleeping, and we were on our way home. So
what was the journey back on the Liverpool like? Was it with a convoy?
Yes, we came back covering a convoy, and when we got to sea, the captain broadcast to the crew. Before we got to sea, he broadcast to the crew that we were escorting a convoy back, and he was hoping that the Hipper would come out, because he could deal with the Hipper, and he wanted to settle a score with her, and he gave him a good pep talk. He said, and with a bit of luck, the Tirpitz might come out, we can have a crack at that. But I didn't think much of that. Anyway, then he broadcast to him that submarines were raid across the mouth of the inlet, and they wanted to clear the inlet. Evidently the submarines got on the bottom of the inlet and fired torpedoes aspread, and he said he wanted to clear the inlet at maximum speed. The convoy had sailed that morning, dinner time or sometime, and then all of a sudden the ship started going round in circles, and he circled the inlet, and then deck started throbbing, and one of the crew that were passing said, oh, he's told us he wants to clear the inlet at 28 knots, and he's winding it up now. And then all of a sudden, shoot, and we were out of the inlet and away, and then we were circling convoy, and every now and again you went and looked at the convoy. I don't know how many it lost coming back, but it lost a few. And I think it was about a 10 or 12 day trip back to Iceland, and then we anchored in, went into a fjord and anchored there for a while. I think it was overnight, I'm not sure. We didn't have to do watches coming back. We were just classed as sick passengers. But the commander came down and thanked us for being no trouble and made us welcome aboard his ship, and, you know, that sort of stuff. And they gave us a towel and a bar of soap and a razor, and we got fed. And I forgot now we got fed. But sleeping, we couldn't sleep. We were having bother with his feet. It just felt, you could feel your heart throbbing, and as if blood run down your feet, and it wouldn't run right to end of them, and it would just seem a bump. You know, like hot water pipes go bump, bump. It would just like that into your feet, And every time you put your feet down, you could feel every bone in your foot. From your heel to your foot, you could feel every bone. It was just as if you had no flesh under your feet. It was painful. Mind you, it had been painful. We'd been 12 days or so laid with his feet up. When we walked about in Murmansk, we had these bandages on, so they softened it a bit, but it was painful. Anyway, we got back to Iceland, and then the amusing part about it, she set off on her own from Iceland, and all of a sudden a big swerve. We said, "What's that?" We went on deck. They'd just seen a mine and gone round a mine. Oh, good heavens. But she came back from Iceland to Scapa Flow in just over about 30 hours. It took us 5 days to get up there. Shows you the difference. Anyway, went to Scapa Flow, and they put us in HMS Amarapura hospital ship. And there were a kid there that had lost his foot, I think it was his left foot now, on one of the escorts going up, because there were several of them damaged when they fought the destroyers. And there were a scouse there, a Liverpool lad, and he'd got some shrapnel in his throat, side of his throat, his neck. And he'd said, I remember him saying to the doctor, surgeon, get this out, I don't want my ticket, I want to stop in this war, I was in it when it started, I want to be in it when it finished. And I was sat outside of his bunk as he come round. They told us to sit there, coming round from anaesthetic, and doctor came up, surgeon came up, and he said to him, I couldn't get it, but I'm sending you down with full notes to my friend in Aberdeen. He'll get it with a magnet. I'm sure we can get it out, and you'll be all right, and you can stop in the Navy. Just think, everybody would try to get out, and he wanted to stop in. Anyway, I was there for about 4 or 5 days, and then I had to go on deck. I was getting sent to Portsmouth, and Robinson were going back to Southport. And we went on deck, and we had to fall in at 9 o'clock to see the commander, the captain, surgeon captain. And he said to me, how old are you? I said, I'm 19. He said, tell me the truth and you won't have to go back to sea. And nowhere did he believe I was 19. I was 20 then, actually. He said, I was 17. He said, tell me the truth and you don't have to go back to sea. Anyway, I said, no, I'm 20. He said, well, you can go back, but I don't believe you. Anyway, he gave us a piece of paper, and it said, this is Austin Byrne, PGX 312974, that was my number. And then we got on the ferry, it took us to another ferry. The drift that took us to a ferry, it took us to Thurso in Scotland. Well, Thurso were a prohibited zone for security reasons, and there's everybody crowding to get off this here tender, this ferry boat, and there were two very smart men on the quay pointing to us to come to the gangway, and they said, nobody gets off, want them to. Anyway, we'd that they get out of his way and let us get off, all these soldiers and sailors going on leave, and they were cursing and swearing. And this fella said, are you the two survivors? I said, yes. What's your number? They only know we're survivors, they didn't even know his names. Anyway, he said, right, come with me. So he took us through, and they must have been senior detectives or something, because they were very nicely dressed. And I worked at weaving, I worked in high quality worsteds, and I could tell a good suit when I saw one. And then they took us through there and checked us out, and he said, your train goes at 8:30 tonight. This was it afternoon then. He said, do you want something to eat? We said, yes. Have you got a meal chip? We said, yes. He said, no, you don't need that. Come on, I'll take you something to eat. So he took us to this here, like a farm affair, and it were a very beautiful whitewashed cow shed or something, barn, with all lovely scrubbed tables. And he said to the lady, she said, oh, are they? He said, they're English. And he had to talk to us. She was ever such a nice lady. He said, he told her what had happened to us. Good grief, she said. He said, I'll sign for their meals. So he signed the form. He said, keep your chits, you'll need them. I'll sign your form, he said. And we got two eggs and beans and chips, I think it was. Well, great. And then we caught the 8:30 train at night from Thurso, and it stopped. I think we're at Perth at first thing at morning, and there were a restaurant car on it, were run by some organisation, and everybody out at carriage had to go out at carriage and go to the restaurant car together, and you got your breakfast. And then it stopped at Preston, and Robinson got off to go to Southport, and that was more or less end of my relationship with him. And from there I went to London, and we got into London at 7:30 at night. And I didn't know about staying anywhere, and there were two other lads up train. They said, oh, it's no good going out of Portsmouth tonight, you'll only have to sleep rough. Come, we'll take you to Union Jack Club. So with my brown paper parcel under my hand, I went to the Union Jack Club. I think it was 1 and 6, and I got a bed. And then we went down next morning, and I went into... I'd never been in Big Royal Naval Barracks before. I didn't want to go again. I went into the joining office, and they said, "Who are you?" And then all of a sudden, they had a conference, and they took me to Chief Master at Arms on the quarter deck, and he said, "Who are you?" So I told him. "Good heavens," he said, "you're English." I said, "Yes." "What are you?" So I told him, "I've gone off a merchant ship." "Where have you been?" I said, "I've been to Murmansk." Anyway, he said, "Sit down and tell me all about it." So I started telling him a story. And all of a sudden, he just looked at his secretary. She walked out and come out with 2 cups of tea and 1 for herself. And he said, "Right," he said, "you go on survivor's leave now for 14 days. He said, "This is a list of what you've got to do. And in my barracks, a survivor doesn't queue. He said, if anybody gets in your way, come straight, take his number and come straight back to me." Anyway, I got all these jobs to do, and I went, got my hammock, and this old AB hammock bedding department said, "Leave it here, I'll lash it up for you. As you get your other stuff, bring it back and put it in your kit bags and get off on leave." Anyway, I got in one queue, and one bloke started, I didn't get to queue, otherwise you couldn't have got through it there. One bloke started shouting it off, and the fella told him, he said, "With that name on that chit, if you book it, you'll be out of here in a draft within 2 hours. So he didn't. Anyway, eventually I had to find the claims office, and I couldn't find that, and I thought it was a priest. I called him Father. He said, "No, I'm Anglican." I said, "It makes a difference to me." So he said, "I'll find it for you." So he took me, and he said to the fella, the Lieutenant Commander Paymaster, "Will you say to this fella?" So I said, "Who is he?" So I told him, and it would just be stand easy. So I said to this fella, "Take your stand easy later, will you?" And say to him, he said, "Yes." So I said, "Now then, your claims." He said, "You had so-and-so, and I thought I know where it was. He ticked everything off. I said, "I didn't have all them." "They don't know," I said. So I got issued with all them, or credited with them. And then I'd got all my kit, and I got changed into uniform, and went back to Master Arms. I said, "I've done it all." "Right," he said, "now then, you want another base. Where do you sail from last time?" I said, "Glasgow." He said, "Well, let's try Liverpool. It might be better this time." "Where do you live?" I said, "Bradford." "Oh," I said, "try Liverpool." So he said, "Report to Liverpool so-and-so date." Anyway, he said, "Now, get you to the station. Let's see, you can catch the so-and-so train." Well, there were some old fellas outside with barrows to where you kicked at the station. I think they charge you 1 and 6 or 6 pence an article. And so he went out and he said, "Take this boy to the station and no charge, and when you come back, you're the head of the queue." So I got to the station, I said to this fellow, "What the hell?" He said, "You heard the man." He said, "Because if I charge you, and he got to know, he won't let me stand outside his barracks again." I thought, good-o. So with that, I got on the train, and this fellow said, "Hello, who are you?" I didn't know where he was. I said, "Oh, I'm going home." He said, "You look rough." So I said, "Yep." He said, "Where have you been?"